Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think of your goals. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If you want to learn a new language, you absolutely should get Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I absolutely love Babbel because their courses help me learn real-life conversational skills. It's so easy to learn how to order food, ask for directions, speak to the locals without having to consult language apps. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time offer for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/SPP. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/SPP. That's spelled BABBEL.com/SPP. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Smart People Podcast, a podcast for smart people, where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people. Hello and welcome to Smart People Podcast, conversations that satisfy your curious mind. Chris Stemp here. Thanks for tuning in. Have you ever heard somebody say that they don't regret anything because everything they've done has gotten them to this moment and they wouldn't change it for the world? I always wondered that because the truth is, yes, everything you've done has gotten you to this moment. But what if you would have changed the past and it would have gotten you to a better moment? And I'm not saying that's a healthy or good way to look at things, but it is true. Every day we make thousands of decisions that clearly alter the path of our lives and other people's lives in the world at large. I mean, think generationally. Think about the number of things that need to happen to put you here. My point is this. We are all a system of chaos and flukes. But why does that matter? Why does understanding chaos actually help as opposed to hurt? I mean, if nothing matters and everything is random, then what's the point, right? That's exactly what we talk about this week. Our guest this week is social scientist Brian Kloss. Brian earned his doctorate in philosophy at Oxford and is now a professor of global politics at University College London. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, host of the award-winning Power Corrupts podcast, and frequent television guest. He's the author of the new book that we're discussing today called Fluke: Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. We're getting our newsletter into high gear, so make sure you are signed up so you get recaps of episodes, updates, upcoming guests, and more. Go to smartpeoplepodcast.com, scroll down to the bottom, newsletter. We don't sell your stuff. We don't give it to anybody. It's safe, secure, all that good stuff. And send this to a friend. It's always the best way. Send it to a friend, tweet about it, X about it, TikTok about it. Be the smartest person in the room. Let's get into it. Our conversation with Brian Kloss as we talk about his new book, Fluke: Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. Enjoy. Tell me, what's the general thesis premise of Fluke?
Yeah, so it's basically applying chaos theory to humans. Chaos theory is this idea that small changes can have big impacts in systems over time, and it's a very well-verified theory and concept that's mostly applied to the physical world, and I'm trying to apply it more directly and systematically to our own lives, our societies, and so on. And the argument that flows through that is that our lives, our societies, our world are much more affected by small, often random feeling events than we imagine. And so the sort of neat and tidy world that we like to picture doesn't actually exist, that actually our lives are swayed by these tiny little changes that over time end up producing major, major effects.
So we're going to talk about chaos theory. We're going to talk about how this impacts us. Before we get into that, I want to zoom out, because as I look at previous books you've written, it seems more in line with your background. So tell me a little bit about how those previous books, which are more political, tie into something like chaos theory.
Yeah, so I'm a political scientist by training. That's what my PhD's in. And what I would do is I would go around the world and I was studying, like for my PhD, for example, I was looking at rigged elections and political violence. So I would interview people who had like carried out a coup plot or rebels in, in a sort of rebel army or whatever in various places around the world, sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, or Southeast Asia. And what was really interesting is at the same time I was doing quantitative analysis, right? So I was building models and trying to sort of discern how the world works politically through modeling. And there's this total disconnect between the two, because modeling forces you to basically cram reality into this really neat and tidy pattern where everything can be explained by a small number of variables and you get a regression equation that sort of spits out, oh, here's how the world works. And then you go and talk to these people, right? And ask, like, why did you do the coup? And it's very often idiosyncratic reasons, personality disputes, things where, as I write in the introduction to Fluke, in one instance, I interviewed a soldier where a coup plot failed, I think, in a split second because he didn't grab a general's trouser leg or pant leg quite hard enough, and basically he slipped through his fingers. And I think if he had a little bit better grip or was half a second faster, I think Zambia's government would have fallen. So I sort of had this, longstanding disillusionment with my discipline, in the sense that I was writing about politics, I was writing about power, but always in the back of my head, I'm like, there's a part of me that's being a little bit dishonest here, not because I'm misleading people, but because there's so much focus on what we often call the signal that we are told the noise is meaningless. And I don't think it's meaningless. I think it's super important. And so this book, in a way, is trying to say, like, what happens if we actually pay attention to the noise? And I think the answer is it's very, very important. And we make huge mistakes when we imagine that we can just reduce reality to the models. And I think that's where the sort of professional and intellectual evolution of Fluke came about.
While we're on the topic, you mentioned your last couple books and you mentioned rigged elections. Let's just go there. Was the last election rigged? The last presidential election, was it rigged? What do we know?
Yeah, no, it wasn't. So it's ironic. I mean, it's a strange thing to be an election rigging expert. I wrote a book called How to Rig an Election. It's a strange thing to be an election rigging expert in a moment when it's very, very prominent in American political discourse back home. Basically, the irony of it is that the U.S. has problematic elections. So things like gerrymandering are really bad in the U.S. They're internationally bad, which is to say that drawing district lines based on the politician's preferences as opposed to where you would draw them if you were not self-interested, right? So the U.S. is like internationally extremely bad on gerrymandering. It's bad on things with voter suppression. It's bad on things with money in politics, the influence of money in politics. What it's really good at internationally is the one thing that Donald Trump says was rigged, which is it's very, very good at counting votes and verifying the integrity of whether voters should be allowed to cast ballots. So, those who are Republican-leaning will not like that message, but it is the kind of thing where the evidence has been examined systematically over and over and over. And it's one of the few things that I would say American elections are exceptional at is vote tabulation. So that's the great irony of this whole what is a false claim.
It is pretty amazing. You wrote a book called How to Rig an Election. I mean, that irony, like, when did that hit you and how did it hit you? And what did you want to say to the American public in that moment?
Well, I mean, what I have said, and I've been interviewed about this, is just, the great irony of it is that there are things that are problematic about American elections. I mean, if you look at gerrymandered districts in the United States, and this is something both parties do, but currently more Republican states have done it because they've had more control of legislatures. If you look at it, it is the case that, the U.S. is an international outlier in having gerrymandered districts in which politicians pick their voters rather than voters picking their politicians, right? Because the politicians draw their own lines. And so, like, I want to have a conversation about electoral reform in the United States. It's just that we're focused on all the wrong things. There are serious concerns. Like, you look at the average margin of victory in the U.S., and for congressional House races, it's, often 20 to 30%. They're landslides. And this is very bad for our democracy. And that's because of gerrymandering. It's something called demographic sorting, which is to say that Republicans live near Republicans and Democrats live near Democrats. So it's hard to draw districts that are competitive anyway. But like there are serious problems. And the role of money in politics is insane in the US. I mean, it's a huge international outlier. So like there's a debate to be had. And it's very unfortunate that the debate that is being had is about the stuff that actually we're already good at. Because there are systems to verify voter, voter fraud. And when, like George W. Bush's administration looked for this, the DOJ has looked for it repeatedly. Every systematic analysis has not found any widespread voter fraud ever. And so, you know, I think this is the kind of stuff where every so often you find a case, but it's not millions of people. It's not even tens of thousands of people. And the reason is because it's totally irrational to commit voter fraud because you go to jail for a very long time if you're caught, and you're almost certainly going to not affect the results of the election.
Oh, that's such a I mean, I won't say that the people who entertain these ideas are always using that level of logic, but that is a great point to make. You mentioned a couple of issues that we have with gerrymandering, money in politics. Why are these things still an issue?
Well, I think there's a series of things. Part of it is vested interests in politics, right? I mean, there's a lot of lobbyists and politicians who both benefit from the system, but it's also things like the Supreme Court ruling of Citizens United, which effectively equated speech to political donations. So, you know, I think these are mistakes, but I think these are the things that are, you know, longstanding problems with American democracy, and we'd be much better off debating those terms rather than stuff that are the figments of Donald Trump's imagination.
Thank you for that. I just wanted to touch on it. Those interested in it, check out your book, because you do talk about rigged elections globally. You do talk about this happens. I think it's important to talk about for the vast majority of people listening in America, like, how does this translate to our first world democracy? It's quite different. So getting back to Fluke and what got you there, I was in preparation for this, I was thinking about the idea of chaos theory and relating it to humans. And I want to talk about this neat and tidy world, because I tend to feel like I lean a little more towards this belief that there is chaos and luck drives most things. But what I realized is it fair to say when you work in politics, when you work in government, where people are so focused on influence, their ability to make change, their ability to essentially drive the lives of millions of people, do you think that the idea of chaos theory is less accepted in that world of politics than it is for maybe outside of that?
Well, I think it's less accepted by most of the world. I mean, I think I'm swimming upstream with my argument, because I think that we're told from a very early age that everything happens for a reason, and that in order to live the American dream, you sort of have to just make your own luck. And all these things happen because of deliberate human action, right? And, you know, I think there's a story that opens the book, which I think illustrates the sort of absurdity of that point of view. And it's a story of a couple that goes on vacation to Kyoto, Japan in 1926. And they fall in love with the city. And you think, okay, why does this matter? Why do I care whether a couple goes on vacation to a certain city? Well, 19 years later, the husband is America's Secretary of War. And they're deciding where to drop the atomic bomb. And the target committee decides to drop it on Kyoto. And so the man, Henry Stimson, meets with Harry Truman twice to get it taken off the list. And the first bomb goes to Hiroshima instead, right? All because of this vacation they took 19 years earlier. And you think about this from the perspective of a resident of Kyoto, right? Like you imagine, okay, you unknowingly avoided being incinerated because a couple took a vacation almost two decades earlier and just liked your city. Now, you know, we think about these things and there's sort of, you know, if you were trying to model, if you were trying to say, like, why would the U.S. decide where to drop the first atomic bomb? The model would come up with a series of very obvious variables tied to, like, you know, the war value of the city, the strategic or propaganda value of the city, et cetera. You would never model the vacation histories of American government officials, right? Like, it's just, it doesn't make sense. So this is the kind of stuff where I think in politics, like, we always write history backwards. So we say, oh, well, like, this was inevitable. And I even, you know, I touch on 9/11 in the book. I have a story about timing later on in the book that is very bewildering about how being in the right place and right time can affect life and death moments. But also, you know, one of the things you think about is, like, if September 11th had been September 10th or September 12th, it would have played out differently. Because on September 10th, there were these massive storms on the East Coast. So, like, you probably would have had some of the planes delayed. And therefore, the attack would have been maybe half successful, right? Maybe only one of the World Trade Centers gets hit, or only one target gets hit. On September 12th, let's imagine that the passengers on Flight 93 are a little bit different, and maybe one of them isn't brave enough to take down the hijackers, and either the White House or the Capitol gets destroyed, right? Like, then January 6th is maybe not going to happen if the Capitol doesn't exist anymore. So, you know, these things, what we tend to do is we tend to just take, like, what happened, and we stitch together a narrative that says, like, oh, this was inevitable, or, like, this happened for these four reasons. But, you know, it's totally arbitrary. Even the exact same attack happening on a different day will have a different outcome. And so, you know, there's this aspect of chaos theory that basically leads to the argument that I put throughout Fluke, which is that we control nothing, but we influence everything. And this is true for literally every action we have. There's a ripple effect to everything that we do, including this conversation, right? Like, it will affect the thinking of someone listening, possibly in a small way, possibly in a big way, but it will have an effect. And we can't know what those effects are, but when we're told, you know, the signal and the noise dichotomy, or we're told that politicians are in control, I mean, it's just, it's an absurdity. It's not true. And I think it's just very comforting to imagine that we're sort of like driving the ship, as it were, or steering the ship. We're not. We're influencing it. And I think that's a very important distinction to make, because the philosophy that comes out of a world of control is radically different from a world that comes out of often unforeseen influence, where you can't know exactly what's going to happen, but you're actually making an impact on the system.
Okay. Really well put. It's like you've done a lot of interviews on it and wrote an entire book on it.
This episode is brought to you by Rocket Money. I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now, I use Rocket Money, and it does all of that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. With Rocket Money, I have full control over my subscriptions and a clear view of my expenses. I can see all of my subscriptions in one place, and if I see something I don't want, Rocket Money can help me cancel it with a few taps. I love how the dashboard shows me this month's spending compared to last month's, so I can clearly see my spending habits. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/smart. That's rocketmoney.com/smart. One last time, rocketmoney.com/smart.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the, we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
But I'll tell you, give you a glimpse into, and the listeners a glimpse into, when I was preparing for this, I was really struggling because I'd like to think that I already believe what you're saying. And you're saying it's swimming upstream. And I'm like, but do I, et cetera. As you're going through it, I think the distinction is this idea of control versus influence. Because, I mean, there's this old saying, right? Oh, you could get hit by a bus tomorrow, which is insinuating that we understand randomness, but you're saying we don't. What are we actually thinking there?
I love this question, because one of the things that's actually been surprising, you know, the book's been out for a month, so I've gotten some reactions to it. I've been very, very pleased with how people have reacted and sent me all sorts of stories and so on. But the thing that's really astonished me is that I think everyone does intuitively understand this. I think the problem is that every social structure we have is telling you not to understand your intuition, right? Because when you think about your own life, you know that there's loads of things that could have turned out differently, but for a tiny change. Like, you're completely aware of this. Everyone has a story like this. Now, the bewildering factor of this is that you don't realize the things that were important most of the time, right? Because we're blind to them. We can only see one version of reality. There's a great film that explores this idea called Sliding Doors from the 1990s, where Gwyneth Paltrow's character either gets on a train or misses it by a split second, and her life completely diverges. But in both instances, she's oblivious to the alternative possible pathways she could have had but for that train. And for me, you know, one of the really dark stories that opens the book, the second story in the book, is a story about a woman named Clara Madeline Jansen, who is in a farmhouse in a place called Keeler, Wisconsin in 1905. And she has a mental breakdown. She snaps. And she decides to take the lives of her four young kids and then take her own life. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because my great-grandfather came home to find her. She was his first wife. And all the kids were dead. And I wouldn't exist but for this mass murder, because he remarried my great-grandmother, and then that created the lineage for me. But the reason I bring it up in this sort of context is because I didn't know this was true until my dad told me when I was like 25 years old, right? So like for like the first 25 years of my life, there's this bewildering mass murder 119 years ago that I don't know that I owe my existence to. And that's just how our lives are. There's a million things that could have gone differently, and we're blind to them, right? So what I'm trying to say is, like, look, that is totally accepted by most people. Like, I don't get a lot of pushback on the mechanics of that. What I get pushback on is, like, except for, like, our economy runs on the myth that that's not true, right? Because our economy runs on this idea that we can, like, put everything into this model, which is not the real world, and then make decisions based off the model and imagine that noise is unimportant, what people call noise, right? And that you can tease out the signal and ignore all the randomness. I mean, the Stimson vacation, the one I was telling you with Kyoto and Hiroshima, that was noise, right? Where somebody goes on vacation in 1926 is not part of signal in anyone's conception until the moment it is. And that's how contingency works, right? This idea, if I was titling the book accurately, it would probably be called contingency, but it's not a very good word. But it basically means that it's contingent moments are ones where small changes can have big effects, right? So I coined this term of the snooze button effect, which I think everyone intuitively understands that when you hit the snooze button, you don't think about it. But if you do think about it, your life will be different depending on whether you get up now or in 5 minutes, because you'll meet different people. You'll potentially have different conversations. All sorts of things will ripple out of that snooze button, right? Whether you do it or don't. And we don't think about that because we're trained to imagine that the little stuff doesn't matter. And I think that's all the, you know, the aspects of society and so on. So I'm not swimming upstream in our intuition. I think that our intuition and our understanding of our own lives is completely aligned with the message of Fluke. I think the thing is that when you extrapolate out from individuals to groups of people, we just completely forget this. And that's what I was talking about when I was describing, you know, the dichotomy between modeling politics and like interviewing people about why they carried out a coup plot, is the messiness is actually what's driving things for people. And then we abstract away from the messiness to try to get something useful. The problem is it's not particularly useful if we're always wrong. And I, you know, this is one of the things I say as a social scientist, we're almost always wrong. I don't mean that we can't know anything about the world. I mean that for the big stuff, like the black swans, they come out of the noise and we never predict them. And I'm sort of arguing that part of the reason for that is because we have this inevitable aspect of reality, which is tied to chaos theory, that is simply fundamentally unpredictable.
Do you think we could predict them? Even if I had a PhD, a triple PhD in what you're talking about, would it make me any better at predicting what's coming from noise?
No. So this is the thing where there's a very useful term that the former governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, calls radical uncertainty. And I think it's a very useful term. It's basically a situation in which there is literally no information available to you in which you can figure out how to navigate decision making, right? And this is the kind of stuff where black swans, or sometimes, you know, Donald Rumsfeld called it unknown unknowns, whatever it is, it's the stuff where you literally cannot use any information to make a good decision. So the example they use, which I borrow in Fluke, is when President Obama is deciding what to do with the raid to kill Osama bin Laden. And they don't know whether he's in Pakistan. They don't know whether he's in the compound. And they don't know what will happen if SEAL Team 6 goes in, right? And there's literally no information that will help them make that decision, because you can look at how SEAL Team 6 has performed in other raids and it will tell you they're good. But we already knew that, right? So is it going to be successful this time? Well, they don't know, right? Is when they get to the compound, is he going to be there? You know, he asked his advisors and they made guesses. They basically said, well, you know, 60% probability. It's not based on a calculation. It was a gut feeling. It was like, yeah, I think so.
Wait, they actually made that up?
Yeah, no, so this is there's a famous description of exactly what happened. He went around the room and said, I want a number, right? And the point that they're making in the book, in the book Radical Uncertainty, which, you know, I'm riffing off of, is that at some point you have what are called confidence-based probabilities versus frequency-based probabilities, right? So frequency-based probabilities are coin flips. It's like, you know, you flip a coin, there's actually a mathematical equation that's going to govern what happens. Confidence-based are just subjective. They're just, you know, how do you feel about this? And it's not a probability at all at that point, right? It's like a gut instinct. And we use them interchangeably, which causes people to make mistakes. But in that moment, there was literally no information available to Barack Obama that would help him make that decision. He just had to guess. And so what's really important is differentiating between the kinds of decisions or systems in which each form of uncertainty exists. So like in a baseball game, you don't know who's going to win, but there are very strict rules and there's only a set of possible outcomes. Only one of the two teams can win. You know, we know that they're not going to score a million runs. It's impossible, right? There's like, there's constraints. And that's where like analytics are really, really good. And that's why moneyballing worked. Because the system is super closed, it's got really clear rules, and there's a very confined set of outcomes. Most of our world, most of the social world, is not at all like that, right? Because like we don't know whether a terrorist attack will blow up some of the biggest buildings in New York, or whether there'll be a financial crisis tomorrow, or you know, whether someone gets assassinated. These black swan events are literally impossible to predict. And so when you're in that world, if you try to apply the sort of old tools of data analytics, even with machine learning, that doesn't solve the problem, the underlying problem. There's no past information that would help you navigate an uncertain future when you're in radical uncertainty. And this is the stuff where I fear that like the shiny tools of increased, you know, improved technology blind people to the underlying logic of this. Like machine learning is so powerful for something like baseball, because it's taking past data in a world where the past is very, very predictive of the future. That's not true for complex social systems. Like our lives, it's very, very difficult to predict how our lives are going to unfold. And machine learning, you know, maybe on aggregate will be relatively good at telling you, you know, how much poverty there will be in America. But for trying to predict an individual, it's no better than a guess. And I think this is the kind of stuff where, you know, there's aspects of this where our hubris causes us to make mistakes. And this is where the distinction between control and influence is really important. Because if you believe you're in control and you can manipulate variables at your whim, then you will be overconfident and you'll make catastrophic errors in judgment.
Okay. Obviously, we're going to get into what to do with this. Because this happens every now and again. I feel like there's some keys here that can really positively impact lives. So we'll get to that. I want to go back to something you said. You said the snooze button effect, which I love. You said, we don't think about it because we're trained that it doesn't matter. I would offer a counter argument, which is we don't think about it because even if it matters, we don't know how.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think they're both true, basically, right? I think we're told to sort of not sweat the small stuff because it all sort of washes out. I do think that there's a lot of thinking in society that's like that, where it's like, it doesn't really matter, right? I'll give you an example of that real quickly before I get on to the idea of because I agree with what you said, your counter argument, I also agree with. But the sort of don't sweat the small stuff or the noise argument. When I was telling that story I told you about the atomic bomb to a historian friend of mine, he said, look, you know, whether they drop the bomb in Kyoto or Hiroshima, the US still wins the war, right? And I'm like, yeah. But like it wins the war differently. And then that's going to have ripple effects. They're going to affect how Japan develops, right? Like there's different people, 100,000 people in two different cities are going to live. That's going to have an impact. And like the second atomic bomb was supposed to get dropped on Kokura. So there's a very specific instance of this. The second atomic bomb was supposed to get dropped on the city of Kokura, but there was cloud cover for the 5 minutes when the bomber arrived. So it left and went to the secondary target, which is Nagasaki. And if you've ever heard of the F scale for tornadoes, like an F3 tornado, the guy who came up with that, who has a huge influence on meteorology, he was in Kokura at the time that the atomic bomb would have been dropped. So the whole field of meteorology might have unfolded totally differently, right? One of the most prominent evolutionary biologists, Motu Kimura, was in Kyoto when the atomic bomb would have been dropped. So that field might have developed differently, right? And those are just two examples that we know about, right? There's all sorts of people who died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that may have changed the world in profound ways that we'll never know because they're dead. So, you know, what we try to do when we make sense of reality is we try to put everything into a category, win the war, lose the war, right? My argument is the categories are artificial. The world is this continuous process of an infinite number of causes and effects. And you can't just say like, oh, it would have washed out. So I think that form of thinking is ubiquitous, but it's wrong. What you said, I agree with, which is that part of the reason people don't think about this stuff is we just can't, it's overwhelming, right? It's like impossible to know and it's overwhelming. It's like you turn right instead of left when you leave a building, your life will change, right? But we don't know how, so we just don't think about it. I think the point is that there's not actually a better or worse way to live. It's not like I look at the snooze button and strategically think like today I'll do it, right? You're right, it's impossible to know. I think instead what it does is it changes your philosophy about life. Because if you think the snooze button is meaningless, then a lot of the small stuff in your life is meaningless. If you think the snooze button matters, then everything you do matters, right? And that's the third part of the subtitle of the book, is to say like, I genuinely think that every conversation that you have does something. I don't think there's a throwaway. People, I think they sort of say like, oh, it wasn't a big deal or it was just a normal day. But we've all been on the other side of that where someone has said something to us that stuck with us, right? Either it was like a cutting remark that pissed us off and we didn't say anything, or it like, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. And then you say it to somebody else in a conversation at a bar later or whatever. I mean, these ripple effects are often invisible to us, but everything that we do has a ripple effect. And so it's not that you can sort of navigate reality better. It's not like you don't have a metric for a snooze button. It's that you start to internalize this concept of absolute endless influence. Which isn't to say like we're super, super powerful beyond our wildest imaginations. So there's nothing that we do that's not going to change the world, at least in some small way. And the sort of flippant way I put this with people is I'm like, have you ever heard of Albert Einstein's great, 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 great grandmother? It's like, no. Well, she mattered, because if she didn't exist, you wouldn't have Albert Einstein, right? So like, even when we think that people's lives are unimportant in the short term, like we have no idea how they're going to matter in the long term. And quite literally, my great-grandfather's first wife killing her children is the reason why we're having this podcast, right? Because if that didn't happen, you wouldn't be talking to me because I wouldn't exist. So like, you know, how would she possibly imagine that? There was no podcast in 1905. But, you know, it's like, this is the kind of way that the world actually works. And it's obvious in its logic. It's just we're really resistant to this way of thinking.
People talk about this with physics or astrology or all those things. And machine learning is hopefully going to solve a lot of that for us, which is we are just too limited in capacity. If you start telling me that every decision I make matters, instantly, from an energy perspective, I am exhausted and I cannot function in the way a human needs to function today. Do you think we're resistant simply because of our computational power?
Yeah, so I have, there's a lot of evolutionary biology in Fluke, and one of the chapters is basically talking about how our brains have evolved for pattern detection, right? And pattern detection requires you to have simplified causes and effects, because when you are navigating the world, you don't need to take in every detail of every tree or every detail of every bit of fur on a saber-toothed tiger. You need to know that it's going to eat you, or that that thing might produce fruit that will allow you to live, right? And so you develop these patterns that are simplifications of the world, like, and that you see things as the general principle, but not as the specifics often. Now, if you were to have a cause and effect pattern if you were to have a brain that was hyper attuned to randomness, it would actually be bad for our survival.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Imagine that you're in the hunter. So most of human history is hunter-gatherer period, right? Like this is most of the time that human evolution has happened is very, very different from how we lived. And we had to worry about predators that might eat us, right? Now you imagine you see like a rustling in the grass. You hear a rustling in the grass. Now, if you're a human who says, oh, it's probably nothing. I don't need to do anything because it's probably just random. Maybe it's just some wind. And it turns out to be a saber-toothed tiger, you die. On the other hand, if you over-detect the pattern, if you say it might be a saber-toothed tiger and it turns out to be a rustling in the grass, or it turns out to be a saber-toothed tiger, you live because you've run away, right? So the point is that evolution basically forces the brain over time to be more and more attuned to pattern, because false positives in which you falsely detect a pattern are not dangerous, whereas false negatives where there is a pattern and you don't detect it is often deadly. So it creates this sort of winnowing effect where our brains are hyper-attuned to straightforward cause and effect narratives. Now, there's two problems with this. One is that the world is no longer like this, right? X causing Y is never the way that reality works any longer. Like trying to model the economy with one variable our brains evolve for that, right? Our brains evolve to have really simple stories about cause and effect. And it's how, you know, like we have these throughout our lives, this causes that, and it's always one-to-one, which is never how the world actually is. And then the other thing that's important about this is we don't acknowledge that the way that we perceive reality has been shaped by evolution. Like there are like literally millions of forms of wavelengths of light, yeah, for example,
that we don't see.
Can't detect.
Yeah.
Right? Because our eyes just evolved to be useful to us. So, you know, like we can't see X-rays, gamma rays, all this. I mean, they all exist. Like, so there's so much about reality that is filtered into our minds through evolved brains. And I think we just presume that there that reality is the way it is. So there's a lot of stuff about, you know, again, the philosophy of this, but also just accepting that like the way we process the world is through this very, very specific brain that has been shaped basically to allow us to survive long enough to have children. And that's basically what the engine of evolution is. So it's sort of arbitrary in that regard.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I have to tell you, you just reminded me of one of my favorite guests who we recently had on, Dr. Julia DeCangi. And we were talking about PTSD. And I asked, like, why would it be so sensitive? Why would it do this? And she said, well, I use the example of fireworks. And she said, well, look, if you were at war, deployed, and these things were going on, if your brain said, I will only tell you it's dangerous if the experience is exactly the same, then it would be completely useless. If the setting had to be identical, then there's no point in remembering it and preparing yourself. And that just changed the way I looked at it. To your point, the pattern detection power of our brain, realizing that it is almost the sole driver, is so powerful. And then realizing how it links up to what you're talking about. Like, we don't even want to see the ability of randomness because it then completely negates how we've evolved, essentially.
Well, this is also why, you know, in the modern world, why conspiracy theories are so sticky, right? And they're so hard to debunk. Because what you basically have is sometimes you have something sort of random or arbitrary happen. Like, you know, one of my favorite examples of this that's in the research is Princess Diana's death, not favorite, but it's probably one of the best illustrations of it, is Princess Diana's death, because it was this sort of arbitrary thing where she died in a car accident. And you think we have brains that have evolved to think that big events have big causes. So you can't have a sort of random, banal, minor thing happen to cause this, you know, global news event. Now, this causes, like when you do research on people who are conspiracy theorists around Princess Diana's death, they will simultaneously say that they believe that she is still alive and that the British government killed her, which obviously can't both exist, right? And the reason they say that is because it's more satisfying to have a pattern, a hidden pattern of some sort of cause that was deliberate, it was chosen, as opposed to an arbitrary accident. And so when you have, you know, there's this research by Jonathan Gottschall, he's an excellent author and professor, who wrote this book called The Storytelling Animal. And what he says, he's like, look, the problem with debunking conspiracy theories is that you're taking a person who has evolved to detect patterns and you are telling them there is no pattern. Whereas the people who are in the conspiracy theory, who are part of that group, are not only feeling really, really bonded to each other because they believe they know the secret pattern, but they're being told that, you know, look, this great story you've just been told is a lie. And what actually is the truth is randomness or something that's totally unrelated to something else. These patterns don't exist. And so, you know, to me, that's one of the best explanations for the sort of endurance of conspiracy theories, despite debunking, is that it's just, you know, it's a lost battle. Like, you're trying to tell a brain evolve for pattern detection, ignore the pattern. And when people are exposed to someone who says, oh, I've connected the dots, right? It's like a sort of connect the dots thing where you all of a sudden out of the stars, you see, you know, the bear or whatever in the constellations. Like, that's really, really satisfying to us. And it becomes really difficult. Not like when we look up the night sky and see Orion's belt or whatever, it's impossible not to see that, but they're just arbitrary dots in the sky. And now we see it as a belt. So like once you, it's the same with the conspiracy theory. Like once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. And that becomes very, very hard to grapple with as people who actually are trying to get to the truth, which is often, sorry, but it was sort of random.
That 2 minutes is brilliance. I just, if people listening were distracted there, go back. Because, well, in that little discussion or explanation, I think you hit on so many nuances of human behavior, human motivation. I've never thought about it from the perspective of, okay, what drives conspiracy theory? The belief that a small subset of people have seen the pattern that the rest cannot. And if our brain is literally a pattern detection machine, then you have the secret code, you have the treasure map that nobody else does. And the way it would make you feel inside is like the ultimate brain food. It is telling you, you have done something that no one else can, and our survival will benefit from it. It's just an incredible way to understand so much of how we operate.
I love Jonathan Gottschall. I quote him in the book on this. And I like, this is something that's so ingrained in us that it totally affects how we write fiction. So like, I quote this line from his where he says, you know, look, when you read Harry Potter, you have no idea how Voldemort is going to meet his end or whether he's going to meet his end. Like, you have no idea what's going to happen. But what you know for sure is that he's not going to slip on a banana peel and die, right? Because it would be so unsatisfying to us, right? Like this idea, there has to be the showdown. Everything has to make sense. And like murder mysteries, right? The ones that are good, what a murder mystery is a whole series of seemingly random things, all these little details. And then all of a sudden at the great reveal at the end is, boom, there it all fits together, right? And the murder mysteries that suck are the ones that don't have all the things fit together. They're like, oh, wait, but what about this one thing that you mentioned? Like that didn't fit in the story, right? And like, of course, the real world is full of little red herrings that don't fit in the story. Like that's how the world is because the world is somewhat random. But like the murder mystery genre is so gripping to us because it is a pattern detection machine reading 250 pages that don't make sense and then 10 pages that do, and everything just all of a sudden comes together. And it's a really big sort of dopamine hit for us. And I love murder mysteries. I mean, I read them and I'm like, yeah, like it's really satisfying. But it's satisfying because of evolution. I mean, that's the sort of aspect of this where, you know, it's the kind of stuff that we basically are supposed to try to make sense of. And it really bothers us when we can't see cause and effect. And I think this is where, you know, this is why chaos theory is something that most of the models we use to develop the world, to understand the world, are just not built that way. Because we want to be able to say, like, the economy runs on, like, these 25 indicators. And as long as you understand them, it'll be fine, right? And this is sort of, and you want the economist on TV to say, here's what's happening, right? You don't want the economist to say like, I don't know. I go on TV sometimes to get asked questions about politics. And like, sometimes the answer is, I don't know. Like it's, but you can't say that. Like you, because the whole thing about punditry as well is to basically say, here's the hidden pattern that you haven't thought about. Now you're going to make sense of it. And I'm going to tell you all the trends and all the things. But like, you know, at some point it's a gross simplification where like, you know, a million people get asked who's going to win the 2024 presidential election. The honest answer for literally everyone is I don't know. And no one knows. But like we have to say something because it's unsatisfying to viewers to be told what is totally obvious that no one really knows who's going to win this election, right? Because it's going to be close. Like, yeah.
Is there any benefit to the next time the largest audience you have when you get asked a question like that? If you say, I don't know, nobody knows, and let me tell you why that matters. And do you think there's benefit? And do you think the reason why people don't do that is one, they're unaware, and or two, they know it's career suicide?
Yeah, I think there's a norm that is career suicide if you do that too often. I do say that when people ask me who's going to win 2024. And I get asked this relatively regularly because I'm a political scientist and so on. And the reason I don't know is because it genuinely is radical uncertainty, right? Like okay, so we're recording this in late February. And if you think about 2020, in late February, COVID hadn't really hit America yet. That election was defined to a large degree by the coronavirus pandemic. And that was November, right? So like, something could happen in the next several months that will totally upend the race. And I have no idea what it could be. None of us do because that's the way the world is. So all these people, it's the same with polling, by the way. It's not, you know, there's a lot of people who say polling is useless because they don't understand some of the underlying principles. I'm not of the view that polling is useless, but polling is answering a very specific question, which is not the question it's being presented as. The question that polling is answering is, what does this subset of the population say about whether they will vote for this candidate or that candidate right now? And that is not the same question as who's going to win in November, right? Because you can't ask that question. We don't know. It's impossible. And, like, you know, there's so many things in politics that are swayed by last minute events or changes. You know, I mean, right now, everything is about foreign policy. Foreign policy is probably not going to drive the 2024 election. It's going to be many months away. I mean, you know, so it's just the kind of stuff where, like, I do say this, I do say I don't know. But I think often there's a reward system in punditry, columns, et cetera, which is that overconfidence with certain answers is rewarded in a way that, like, underconfidence with hesitant answers is unsatisfying to readers. But smarter people understand the limits of their knowledge, right? And that's the kind of thing where if somebody is always telling you, oh, I have this secret understanding because I'm cleverer than everyone else, odds are it's exactly the opposite. It's that they have hubris and have not figured out that there are limits to what they could possibly understand about the world.
Brian, not that it's going to matter for you because you've done the research, but I just want to tell those listening, because it was one of the first, when we said we're going to get into TikTok and we're going to start saying, what have we learned from 500 interviews, which I should get back to doing. But my point is, one of the first things when I sat down and said, truly, what have I aggregated? It was this: trust the people who openly admit uncertainty. I will tell you this, the people with the highest pedigrees, the most experience, the most knowledge are sometimes the most frustrating to interview because they will never answer the damn question. They'll be like, well, that's not actually da 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 da, or we don't quite know. And I want to say to them, yeah, look, I know that, but you're the smartest person I'm going to talk to about it. So give me your expectation. And I just think this is, again, a really cool moment to understand, to your point, how much of our reality is shaped from our experience in a way we don't even understand. I would never know that's a major takeaway of talking to 500 brilliant people. I would never even guess it, but then going through and analyzing it. I just wanted to highlight that. Look, I know we only got about 10 minutes left with you, so I got to get into this. What do we do with it? So the first thing I want to ask is, how have you leveraged this information in your own life?
Yeah, so there's a few things. I mean, first off, philosophically, you know, Fluke's argument to a large degree is that there's a lot of arbitrary and seemingly random forces that do shape a lot of outcomes. And I do feel like a cosmic accident. And I don't mean that in, like, a negative way. People, when they sort of get a little bit bewildered when I say that. But I mean that, like, I don't think that there's a grand purpose to my life. I don't mean that in a way that my life's meaningless. I mean that I don't believe that if, you know, my parents had met in a slightly different way, there'd be a different kid, it would have been okay. Like, if that mass murder had happened, hadn't happened, right, I wouldn't exist. Or, you know, if the asteroid hadn't hit the dinosaurs, none of us would exist. So I think there's sort of this arbitrariness. And philosophically, that has, you know, sort of offshoots to it that I've incorporated into my own life that has changed in the last few years. So I think that, you know, the purpose of human life is to enjoy life and to try to make other people's lives better. And I think that that is something where if we accept that we're sort of arbitrary, we also can cut ourselves a little bit of slack, because I think the sort of mythology around the American dream and all of the sort of narratives around success basically tell you that if you're having a setback or a failure, it's your fault. And if you're successful, it's all your credit. I don't believe anything like that is true. So I think that's affected the way I see things. In terms of how to navigate this, and this is the sort of takeaways, you know, I think uncertainty in itself is actually really, really valuable because it teaches you to navigate uncertainty totally differently than if you have a false hubris around control. So the two things that I think you do in your own life or in social systems in general is experimentation and resilience. So what I mean by that is if you think you know exactly how to behave in a system and you have perfect control over it, you don't need to experiment because you just need to optimize to the absolute limit. But if you don't think you know, then you need to experiment a lot more. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff I write about in Fluke of instances where this is true, where forced experimentation actually turned out to be really good. I'll give you a short example that I like from the book. And the economist Tim Harford has talked about this previously, but there's a famous jazz musician named Keith Jarrett who went to perform at the Cologne Opera House. And he had a very, very clear, you know, sort of a control freak over his piano, basically, and said, I want this exact piano. Like, I can't play without this exact piano. Somebody screws up and doesn't order it. So he arrives and there's like this crappy, rickety old piano that's used for like amateur musicians to practice on. It's like out of tune. And he has to play with it because the whole concert hall is filled and he can't cancel last minute. Now, he has to adjust how he plays to the instrument. It's forced experimentation. This is the best-selling jazz album of all time. And it's because he was forced to do something that he didn't actually want to do, but it turned out to be something that produced an incredibly creative sound. And I think there's a lesson there for everyone else, right? Like if you think, and I think about my own life this way, like I would not have ended up where I have if I had plotted out my path when I was like 12 years old or when I was 18 years old, right? Like, and that's the sort of mentality where it's like, if you took a top-down control level attitude towards your life, your experimentation dial would be way down. And my argument is it should be way up, right? Experimenting is what allows us to navigate uncertainty. And the second thing is in radical uncertainty is you build for resilience. So, you know, this is on the social side of things, like one of the examples I write about in Fluke is a power grid in Latin America where they knew it was going to be more expensive and less efficient to decouple the regional grids from the national one, but they did it. And when there was a blackout, it only affected a very small part of the country. And it actually saved them a ton of money in the end because when disaster struck, it was really compartmentalized, right? And this is the kind of stuff where I worry about our social systems now where, like, you know, the Suez Canal got blocked for like weeks because one boat twisted sideways from a gust of wind and it caused like $50 billion in damage because there was no slack in the system. So in our own lives, I mean, the advice that my grandfather told me, which I think is very good advice for a successful life, he said, my life advice for you is two words, avoid catastrophe. And I think it's pretty good advice. I mean, I think it's one of those things where we don't think about this. What we're told instead is here's all the life hacks on how you can optimize to the absolute limit and eliminate every ounce of inefficiency in your daily life. And actually, I don't think that avoids catastrophe. I think that sets us up to not be resilient because if any small thing goes wrong, our whole system breaks down. And I think, you know, it's sort of, you know, these are the philosophical offshoots of a world of chaos theory. And I think they're important to talk about because the mythology of models is one that we've internalized. And I think we're courting disaster much more often than we should.
Wow. There's so many things coming out of this, Brian, for me. So tell me when you wake up or when you plan for a week or when you look at your 10-year plan, knowing this, like you know, I think one of the things you said that resonates is, you know, enjoy life, et cetera. That makes sense. But for those that want to put themselves on a path, right? Like I wanted to live in a house like this. Granted, a lot of things shape that, but I do think my intent, my decisions on a day-to-day basis influenced it. I know they did. I didn't smoke cigarettes when I was 18 because I knew I could get addicted and die. That is true. So where's the middle ground between what we can control or influence and where we just throw up our hands?
Yeah, I mean, so I still, like everyone else, I still use basically a mental model that is probabilistic, right? Like I don't walk into the street hoping that I'll not die because maybe the noise will save me, right? Like I still base my decision-making on what we all do, which is we sort of assume maybe there's this set of probabilities and maybe it will work out if I do this. I mean, it's the same. I'm obviously trying with like my book writing career and so on. But I think that there's a few things that I would say I've personally for my own life, and I'm not trying to tell people how to live, but personally for my own life, I've realized that a lot of the messages I've been told about how to be happy or how to be successful are tied to stuff and status, right? And I actually have realized that for me, those are not the things that have given me like actual fulfillment. And so I think a lot of us are on these strategic paths where we're not questioning what the destination should be, right? I mean, some of the happiest things I do are free and they're like going camping with my dog. Like and I'm not trying to be like, you know, cliche here, but I think it is something where there's so much in the world that's just like beating us over the head of like, if you don't do this, you're a failure. And I'm sort of like, I don't know, like there's a resilience to enjoying stuff that doesn't have strategic thinking. Like I can go camping even if I'm broke. So, you know, this, like once I've bought the tent, it's like pretty much, it's close to free. So this is the kind of stuff where I just think that there are obviously strategies that we should pursue, and humans are striving creatures. I'm not saying give up and just sort of, you know, retreat into a tent. I'm just saying that I think that we should dial up slightly the aspects of our lives that don't require strategic thinking and do just require enjoyment and fulfillment, and dial down slightly the idea that if you don't have the exact scripted life that you imagine for yourself, that you're somehow a failure. Because, you know, a lot of the happiest people that I've met are not people who are super rich. And I've met a lot because of my last book, which is all about power. I've met some extraordinarily rich people, billionaires and so on. And most of them have been really nasty, miserable people.
Yeah, right? They are.
And you know, I think this is the kind of stuff where, like, you know, it's worth saying that. Like, it's worth saying that, like, the script that we've been told about what a good life is not one size fits all. And some people it might be, you know, that maybe money is genuinely fulfilling for them and so on. Then by all means, you know, people will know themselves better. I just don't think there's a one size fits all approach to this stuff. And I think experimentation and thinking about, you know, purpose and so on, in a way that is decoupled from the sort of, you know, American dream, as it were, is for some people, at least, will be useful.
Do you go into this idea, what we just talked about, that last question, in greater detail in your book? Because I haven't finished it.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So the last two chapters in particular are very philosophical about this stuff. And I think it's, you know, I mean, I think it's how you make sense of the meaning of life, right? I mean, and what's really interesting to me actually as a reaction is that a lot of people who are deeply religious, and I'm not a believer myself, but a lot of people who are deeply religious actually have some overlap with the worldview that I have, because they've given up the sense of control. They believe that God's in control. So I'm coming to it from
Do the same thing for different reasons.
Yeah. You can have people who come to the same philosophy from totally different background ideas about where it's coming from. I mean, some people believe that God's in control. I believe, you know, that there's aspects around determinism or sometimes arbitrary forces and so on that chaos theory suggests, but either way, you give up a little bit of the sort of, like, you know, everything that happens to me is up to me. Which is just, I mean, the more you think about it, it's just such an obvious lie. I mean, in every instance that's been important in your life, it has not been true that it's been exclusively up to you, right? Like, there's been a million, and everyone knows that. And then we, like, have all these sayings where it's like, oh, like, you know, the American dream basically tells you if you're poor, it's your fault. And it's just, there's stuff like that where I really question these mythologies, and sometimes their utility for making people happy as well.
I love it. And the reason I want to mention it is because if people are interested and they like what they heard, but they're like, I want more, there is more. I mean, it's part of the podcast. It's the reason it's an hour. We get enough good stuff, but you didn't give away all of it. So, Brian, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I really did. You know, and so the book is Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. Brian, where else can people find you? I believe you have a podcast. So tell us about that and let us know where else you are.
Yeah. So I have a podcast called Power Corrupts. I haven't made it for a few years, but it's still as fresh as always because it's documentary style.
There you go.
And then I have a newsletter that's free to subscribe to called The Garden of Forking Paths. And it has some ideas that are adjacent to Fluke that I write about on a weekly basis.
Love it. Well, we will link to those. Really enjoyed it. Brian, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was lovely to talk to you.
Thank you to this week's guest, Brian Kloss. The episode was hosted, as always, by Chris Stemp and produced by yours truly, John Rojas. Brian's book, Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters, is available wherever books are sold. Now on to the quick housekeeping items. If you'd ever like to reach out to the show, you can email us at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com or message us on Twitter @smartpeoplepod. And of course, if you want to stay up to date with all things Smart People Podcast, head over to the website, smartpeoplepodcast.com, and sign up for the newsletter. All right, that's it for us this week. Make sure you stay tuned because we've got a lot of great interviews coming up. And we'll see you all next episode.